Hello and welcome to episode 6 of the Social Innovation Think Tank, where we discuss the latest ideas and thinking related to social innovation. My name is Paul Tracy. I'm Professor of Innovation and Organisation at the Cambridge Judge Business School and Co-Director of the Cambridge Centre for Social Innovation. As always, we're joined as well by my co-host, Neil Stott, who is also Co-Director of the Cambridge Centre for Social Innovation and who leads the Masters in Social Innovation that we run from the centre. So I'm really pleased to welcome today's guest, who is Rebecca Henderson. Rebecca is John and Natty MacArthur University Professor at Harvard University, one of just 25 university professors at Harvard. She's also a research fellow at the National Bureau of Economic Research and a fellow of both the British Academy and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Now, Rebecca is expert on innovation and organisational change, and her research explores the degree to which the private sector can play a role in building a more sustainable economy. And we invited Rebecca to speak with us today about her new book, which is called Reimagining Capitalism, How Business Can Change the World, How Business Can Save the World, which is published by Penguin. Rebecca, thank you very much for talking with us today. And I guess I'd like to start off by asking you why you decided to write this very interesting book.
Paul, thank you very much, and thank you for having me on the show. The easy answer is because capitalism is broken and the world is on fire, and the students in my course called Reimagining Capitalism insisted that I write the book. The longer answer is slightly more complicated, if I could take a couple of minutes. As you mentioned, my background is in innovation. I spent the first 20 years of my career as the Eastman Kodak Professor of Management at MIT. That was a coincidence, but it's actually a deeply ironic one because that's what I did. I studied very large organizations like Kodak that have been very successful and were having an enormous degree of difficulty changing. And about 15 years ago, I was persuaded that climate change was a huge issue. Initially, I saw Vice President Gore's movie, and I'd been reading the science steadily for a while, but that really catalyzed me. I was like, oh, it's a huge problem. What should I do? And my first thought was that I should simply quit. But after thinking about it and talking to friends, I decided to stay and to try and use some of what I knew about organizational transformation to try and understand what firms needed to do to respond to what I saw as a massive crisis that was coming at us very fast. So I started teaching classes on sustainability, and I started working with energy firms that were trying to remake themselves, mostly European energy firms that were really trying to move into renewables. And I learned fairly quickly that the single thing that would be most helpful would be some kind of price for carbon. I mean, if you're a solar energy entrepreneur and you have to compete with some guy who's burning coal, and the guy burning coal doesn't have to pay for the enormous damage to human health or the climate damage that he or she is causing, you're starting the race with weights on your feet. I mean, everyone says, oh, when will solar be cheaper than coal? It's cheaper right now if you use the real price. And so, you know, I was working with firms that said, you know, if only we had a market signal, if only we had a demand signal, that would make all the difference. And that got me super interested in the question of why business wasn't asking for a market signal. Why wasn't there a massive movement by firms worldwide insisting on a carbon tax? Now that seems like a kind of naive question because I really know the answer to that question or think I do. But at the time, it seemed so obvious. You know, if we'd started moving 15 years ago with a $20 a ton kind of tax, gradually increased it over time, I personally believe that we would have made enormous progress, that we would have released, you know, great waves of innovation. It would have been much faster than we expected. I mean, look what's happened in solar and wind, even just without that kind of signal, and I think we would have really begun reforming transportation and agriculture and infrastructure and buildings and all the other sectors we need to change. So I got super interested in why firms weren't more involved with governments insisting on this kind of policy. And I didn't know the answer because I was an innovation specialist. So in the way of these things, and you know how we do this, I decided to teach a class about it, like how could business really make a difference against the big problems? It was initially going to be climate, but then the students I recruited for my very first go-round said, no, no, Rebecca, it has to be inequality as well. That inequality has all the same kind of feeling as climate. It's a massive public good problem that governments are not addressing. And you need to talk about both. And you need to give us some kind of theory of how business could really help. I mean, yeah, we know we could change a few light bulbs, but really, how could business make a difference? So that's the course I've been teaching for the last few years. It's been amazing. We started with 28 students. Now we're up to over 300. And indeed, the dean has asked me to take some of the key ideas from the course into the required first year course on leadership and governance and ethics, which I now teach. So that's pretty exciting. But the book is basically the story of the course. It's what I think we all learn together about what business might be able to do to save the world.
It sounds a very exciting course indeed, I have to say. So in the book, you outline a vision of what a different kind of capitalism might look like. One that I guess addresses all the shortcomings of the current version of capitalism that we have. I think it would be helpful if you would spend a little bit of time just outlining what you see as the key elements of this reimagined capitalism.
Sure. This is not going to sound very dramatic or very exciting, but for me, reimagined capitalism is reclaiming the idea that free markets work best when they're in balance with democratically accountable, freely elected, transparent, capable government and a strong civil society. My reading of modern development economics, as well as the history of Europe and the US, is that societies really thrive when the free market is held in balance, when government ensures that markets are genuinely free and fair, that externalities are properly priced, if I can get a tiny bit technical, but someone has to pay when they throw greenhouse gases out the window or it should be regulated, and when there's a government to ensure that there's genuine freedom of opportunity. So that means making sure that everyone, regardless of the zip code they're born or the color of their skin, gets the same kinds of opportunities to participate. And it's not that I think government is the answer to everything. I said in balance, you know, a government out of control is just as dangerous as a market out of control. But I see a reimagined capitalism as really about that balance. And one friend who read my book said to me, Rebecca, the book shouldn't be called Reimagining Capitalism. It should be called like Back to the 50s and 60s, only without the racism and the misogyny. I was like, well, sort of, but not quite. Because the other element that I would really like to include under what it means to reimagine capitalism is a different way of thinking about the purpose and mission of firms. I believe very strongly that while there might have been a time at which it absolutely made sense to tell firms their only mission was to maximize shareholder value, that when markets are neither free nor fair, that is no longer appropriate. But most obviously, one of the quickest ways to make money is to get the laws changed in your favor. So if you can get the government to give you a nice tidy monopoly, think cell phones, then, a nice tight oligopoly where everyone's making a ton of money and service is lousy, what a great way to make money. But I'm sure that's not what Milton Friedman meant. You know, maximize shareholder value at any cost surely could not have meant flood the political system with money, persuade people that they have no voice. And I bet it didn't mean destroy the climate, completely destabilize the Earth's climate. I mean, Friedrich Hayek said we have to price externalities. This is not a kind of radical lefty idea. And I think maximizing shareholder value was a kind of shorthand for let's make sure managers put their heads down and really pay attention to their investors and don't feather their own nests. And of course, that's an issue and something we need to think about. But it came with this massive asterisk, which is as long as the rules of the game are free and fair. And when they're not free and fair, when 70% of Americans think that the rich control the political agenda and the political science kind of backs them up, and when more than 50% of the world's population say capitalism is not working for them, something is really wrong. This kind of accelerating inequality, all the money going to a small group. So I think business should acknowledge and act on the idea that it has a responsibility not only to its investors, but also to the institutions in which it's embedded. Now, notice I didn't say stakeholders. I'll come back to that. And I think paying attention to your stakeholders is really important and a really good idea. But in my mind, the first duty is to make sure that competition is genuinely doing what you hope, that firms are not flooding the system with money, and that they are not actively denying things like climate change or actively lobbying to reduce taxes, that they feel themselves part of a much larger whole. Now, of course, I think that there's a business case for thinking that way, and I'm sure we'll get to that. So this is not just the strong moral case, although I do think there's a strong moral case. I think there's a very strong economic case, but I think that's a very different way of thinking about firms. Now, it's related to a focus on stakeholders, but as I said, it's not the same thing. And we can talk more about that if you're curious.
Yeah. So why did you not use the term stakeholder? I mean, the idea of stakeholder capitalism is one that's become so ubiquitous now, but it's interesting that you deliberately decided not to do that.
So I have lots of friends and colleagues who think that a move to stakeholder capitalism is super important, and that's what it means to reimagine capitalism. I think the term is not very clear. And so in some ways, I really agree with them. If what they mean is firms should consider all constituencies as they make their decisions, and wherever possible, try and create shared value for all constituencies, I absolutely agree. I think, I think a focus on explicitly focusing on shared value, it's not just about our investors, we're creating value for everyone in this ecosystem, is absolutely critical. So there I'm in complete agreement. But there is also another important group of a school of thought that thinks that an important step is changing the governance structure of firms. So firms have an explicit responsibility to stakeholder welfare. And, you know, I'm sympathetic. I can see that that might work. We could have a long conversation about, whoa, it's tricky. And yes, they make it work in Germany. But let's think about what happened in Japan. And I'm really worried about agency problems. And investors really still have to be persuaded, even if we change the governance structure. And so there's a whole kind of cloud around this. And then I would add, and I still think changing how we think about government and rebalancing our society is more important. That while changing the governance structure, I could be persuaded it's important, but I don't think it's the critical path, not nearly as important as persuading firms to become more purpose-driven, persuading investors that that's absolutely a centrally important idea. I would put all my money against investors and measurement rather than against changing the law around corporate governance and around changing the politics.
So you mentioned there a little bit about purpose, Rebecca, and so I want to pick up on that idea because the notion of purpose is really central to your arguments throughout the book, and you introduced the concept of a purpose-driven organization. Could you say a little bit more about what you mean by that?
Sure. A purpose-driven organization is one that has a goal beyond simply maximizing profits and that is willing to at least occasionally devote real resources to that goal. And by real resources, I mean not just money and strategic decisions, but I also mean emotional work. For me, one of the characteristics of an authentically purpose-driven company is that it uses high road management practices. And there's been 1,000 names for what this is, but briefly, a high road management style is one where you treat everyone in the organization with dignity and respect, where you pay them decently, give them steady schedule, you give them the tools they need to do the job, and you give them the freedom to make the decisions that they need. And I make the point in the book, and I really believe this is true, I think the research is overwhelmingly clear that managing that way is at the very least competitively viable, and in many circumstances will make you significantly more productive and more innovative than your more conventional rivals. And the reason, I mean, I think purpose-driven firms are important for a huge range of reasons. But one of the most important is that changing the whole economy, which is what it means to build a genuinely just, inclusive and sustainable economy, like that's a big deal, requires organizations to think about things in new ways and to see more broadly. You know, often people say to me, well, do you mean you want to trade off purpose and profits? You know, and I don't believe your both and story. So I think that's just way too simplistic, right? That, of course, a firm has to be profitable in the long run. I mean, I sit on major corporate boards. I understand about pleasing investors. I really get that. But there are many routes to profit. And doing things like running a high road employment system is a very effective route to profit, I think, for many firms in the long term. But it takes extended investment. It takes deep investment over time. And if you're just overwhelmingly focused on money, 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 A, no one's going to believe you're authentically purpose-driven. I mean, imagine the opening speech. We have learned from the research that having a purpose makes a big difference. And so our purpose is to make a difference in the lives of our employees and our customers. And but me, I'm really motivated by I have to make as much money as possible, and that's why I'm here. I mean, no, you know. It's not going to work. So I'm afraid I've lost myself in sort of riffing on what it means to be purpose-driven. But I think what's important about purpose is not bottom line versus purpose. It's this total integration. So you're always seeing profit through the lens of your purpose. And yes, there are some businesses you don't go into and some things you don't do, but it widens your vision and it makes it much more possible to take these kinds of discontinuous leaps. And Paul, I can't resist since you're a colleague. This comes straight out of my work on innovation. I mean, the whole reason I got interested in purpose in the first place is in 20 years of trying to understand what made the difference between those firms who moved and those that didn't. You know, yeah, you had to have a strategy and you had to get the organization right and you had to get the incentives right. But again and again, I kept running into firms that told me we wanted to make the transition. We thought it was important to our customers, or we thought it was the only way we could preserve jobs for our employees. There was an emotional and authentic emotional engagement with the reason to make the change that seemed to make all the difference. And then I did all this work on trust and relational contracts. And I think I understand at least some of the basic mechanisms at play that make that plausibly the case.
I mean, I understand what you mean about high road management. But when people say to me purpose driven, whose purpose? Who defines the purpose? And in whose interest is that purpose?
Ooh, and let me just add, and how would you measure it? Mm-hmm. Right? So, for the moment, I'm just keen to persuade firms and employees and boards of directors that it's about more than just the bottom line next quarter, that there's a moral duty to think more broadly, and there's an enormous economic reason to do so. And the best way to begin that journey is to think about, like, what's your firm about? What is it that you think you create in the world? And so I'm up for all kinds of purposes, Neil, at least in the short term. If a firm says, we've really rethought our purpose and we understand it's delighting our customers, and that means giving them an experience they won't get anywhere else and making sure that no one falls through the cracks and driving down the cost as much as we possibly can, I'm totally up for that. Because I believe, although cannot prove, that if you have a CEO and a senior team that starts to set that direction and a group of employees that starts to work it, it's hard to stop. That once you're really thinking about your customer, not as just the means by which you make your quarterly bonus, but as a person who needs what you're selling and deeply needs what you're selling, and you really start to think that through, that begins to take you down a path towards thinking more broadly. Now, clearly where I want to go, and faster rather than slower, is, whoa, world is burning, society is falling apart, political institutions under enormous stress. You know, what's your role in addressing some of those issues? How do you think about that? And I think our great ally in that is the millennial Gen X, Gen Y. They increasingly want to work for companies that are doing that. One of my friends who's a CEO called me up a few years ago and he said, Rebecca, you know, I think all this stuff about sustainability And I said, yeah, Fred, I know. And he said, but everyone I'm trying to hire is, you know, obsessed with it. So come and talk to me about it, okay? I mean, you're a smart person, come and talk. So I came and talked. And they put in place like the milquetoast version, you know, here are our values, here are our purpose. And the employees were like, oh, great, you know, and it was a great business. I mean, it was doing something really important in the world. But the CEO was an ex-iBanker. He just wasn't used to thinking that way. And what happened over time is one saw that positive flywheel turning. So now that organization is one of the sort of more pro-socially purpose-driven firms I know. Now, the question of how to measure it so that you can communicate that to investors and employees and everyone else, and whether it's really adding up to impact, I think that's a huge open question. And as you know, many of our colleagues are working that absolutely as hard as they can. But I think in the meantime, you know, if we can push just, you know, I know there are only stories, but the number of industry leaders in industry after industry who are pushing the transition towards a greener, more just economy, who are purpose-driven, is enormous. And they are pulling firms behind them. And so even if it's slow and we're not measuring it very well yet, I think it's progress.
That's really interesting. I guess the point that Neil was making, I mean, is we work with a lot of people in NGOs, the nonprofit sector, and a lot of the people that we speak to, this, I guess they're very cynical about companies that say we're purpose-driven, and you know, some of the ones who shout the loudest are maybe some of the ones who have not always been purpose-driven in the past. What would you say to these people? How would you convince them that business is actually capable of moving beyond this idea of shareholder maximization and embracing these dual goals, shared value? When the preach comes to shove, that the social side as well is going to hold up in addition to the profit side.
So first, I would agree. You know, I gave a talk to a conference on worker cooperatives in Cincinnati a few months ago before everything shut down. And I gave my talk and a woman leapt to her feet and she said, Rebecca, I think you're completely wrong. I mean, these guys are going to make money at any available opportunity. We don't need to reimagine this system. We should throw it out the window. And I say, she's not the first person. She was the first, but since then I've heard that a lot. So a couple of thoughts. First, I get how damaging business has been and how evil some businesses are. I absolutely get that. And when you give businesses incentive to make money at any cost, watch what they do. And they've done a bunch of them. You know, no CEO would say in public, well, I love employing child labor because, you know, it's so cheap and their little fingers. I mean, the manipulation is amazing. You know, there is some sense of the flaw, but it is pretty low. So why should we believe that business is going to change? So first, I'm not saying this is a done deal. I'm not saying, oh, business is going to change. Business saves the world. Absolutely not. When people come into my office and say, how can I make a difference in the world? If they're undergraduates and they're still looking at World Wide Open, I say, political activism, get out there and scream. Because nothing changes companies faster than men in gorilla suits on the building and women lying down in front of the trucks. And, you know, we need a big fuss. And in fact, I know many more companies than you'd expect that switched because the children of the CEOs came home from school and said, you know, we're being taught that this company is destroying the planet, Dad. And like, can you do something about that? So if you ask me what I thought would go first, second, and third, major political and cultural movement to reshape business so that we rebalance our society. Done, done, done. Why do I still go on about business then? Why even talk about it? Individual businesses that change can change thousands of lives. So a business that does something simple, like raise the minimum wage, put in stable hiring schedule, really act on diversity and inclusion and invest in its local community, it's changed thousands of lives. So like, let's have more of that. But why should they do it? Well, because, can I say this on this podcast? Business is screwed if we don't fix these problems. I think we may lose capitalism. And I believe that without capitalism, we're not going to solve the problems we face. I mean, when you have half the world's population saying that capitalism is broken, when you have a majority of the young people saying they prefer socialism to capitalism, they probably mean they want decent healthcare, but it's not a good sign if you're a capitalist. And I'm a capitalist. And I haven't even mentioned, wait, we're going to have all the great coastal cities underwater. The thing that's happening in California right now, there's going to be much more of it. The climate scientists say this is just the warm-up. We're going to see harvests fail right across the world. We're going to see millions of angry migrants coming north. Really? We maybe dodged a bullet on Hurricane Laura, although I understand if you were underneath it and you couldn't really get away. The combination of massive flood damage and 100-degree weather was not fun to live through. I mean, this is not good for business. This kind of volatility is not good for business. Now, the question is, when will business really get there? I think the good news, and now I hope you're going to get even more cynical, is that the people with the money are starting to work that out. So I'm sure you saw that yesterday saw the release from the Commodities Commission in the current US administration of a report suggesting that climate change fundamentally threatens the stability of the entire financial system. And of course, in the UK, you have Mark Carney, who was governor of the Bank of England, like almost incandescently, like, no, it's going to bring the whole thing. You know, we really don't want to go here. And, you know, my sample is biased, but I talk to many asset owners who control enormous amounts of money. One of them is Hiro Mizuno, who for a while controlled the Japanese government pension fund, which is the largest pension fund in the world. That's $1.7 trillion in assets. You know, it's 1% of the world's equity. I mean, it's a mind-blowing amount of money. And he has persuaded himself and the Prime Minister of Japan and most of the Japanese business community that, wait, climate change is one of the most important threats to the long-term stability of the Japanese economy. And so is, this is harder, but he's really, you know, making some progress. So is social inclusion. And in Japan, that means actually bringing women into the mainstream of the workforce. And, you know, they think the only way that they will really address their long-term problems. And so, yes, I think this is quixotic. You know, I'm not optimistic. I'm not like, oh yeah, these guys, there's greenwashing and PR all over the place. But large organizations are super complicated and changing them is really hard. I mean, as well as a massive political movement to change the government, we need a massive cultural movement so that everyone, customers, employees, understands that no, the goal of the firm has got to be something different. Could that happen? You know, I think it might. I think COVID has made it more likely.
You mentioned earlier, you know, the 50s and 60s. So, I mean, you don't actually say this in the book, but I mean, are you saying what we actually need is more regulation and more tax revenue?
So, Neil, the book is very carefully written.
I thought so.
What I say is business should get involved in civics, not politics. So I think every business leader should be lobbying hard for a democracy that really works, that really reflects the will of the population. I actually think they should be giving time off to vote. I think they should be lobbying to get money out of politics. To me, this is uncontroversial, that this is absolutely in the long-term interest of the private sector. There are policies that I personally favor and I believe would increase the odds we'd build a just and sustainable society. The one that's by top of my list, this is not going to be a surprise, is a price for carbon. I think that's like an obvious no-brainer and everyone should be going after that. But beyond that, the book is not about what policies are needed. I personally believe that we will need to increase taxes to pay for the education we're going to need, to retool people as AI and robotics starts hitting the societies really hard. I think there are all kinds of government policies around making sure that every job is a good job. But, you know, I'm not a policy wonk. And for me, the important thing is to have purpose-driven businesses. That is, businesses that are genuinely, and again, how do we know genuinely, but really thinking about the whole system in those conversations and beginning to think, you know, like, I hate it, but maybe I should be lobbying to increase my taxes. I hate it. Well, this is the one that most business people hate. Maybe some kind of organized representation for labor is a good thing. You know, I've become so powerful that I need someone to balance that power. I mean, I don't know if you're married, but, and I've only been married twice, and who knows, but I think marriages work best when it's a partnership. That if one person is completely in charge and calls all the shots, no matter how wise and good they are, that's really not a marriage. That's, I don't like what that is. And I think society is like that, and business has become too powerful for its own good. And so should be actively lobbying for this kind of rebalancing.
So in your book, you do talk about collaboration and finding a chord between businesses and society and at local and regional level. In a lot of our work, we look at, you know, cross-sector work, cross-sector partnerships. And I think from a reading of the literature, everyone would like them. It's a good thing to do, but they're incredibly hard to do. There's no one's really cracked. How do we get groups of organizations who are similar, let alone, you know, not like each other, to cooperate, you know, effectively? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes. And that's that you're exactly right. You know, I talk about self-regulation in the book, that when firms work together, that can be very helpful. But in every case I ran into, that bled very quickly into public private partnerships. And I learned what you have just said, which is that everyone thinks they're a good idea, but oh my God, they're difficult. And when I think about where I want to take my research next, I have two candidates. One is, okay, how do you really make a firm more purpose-driven? You know, I know how you do that if you start from scratch, but how do you really take a firm and change it? And I don't think we know nearly enough about that. And the second thing I don't think we know nearly enough about is exactly what you're working on, which is, how do we do this better? What do we know that really works? And there are a number of fantastic people working in the space, but, you know, if anyone's listening who's like, I want to do research and what should I devote my research to, this feels to me like one of the most critical problems. Oh God, and I'm going to get hyperbolic and say facing humanity, because I really believe it. And yes, we have to do the technology and there's all kinds of problems to solve, but this problem, trying to find a way that firms and governments really work together in an effective way, so important.
The other thing, I mean, obviously, you know, we work with quite a lot of social entrepreneurs, as well as, you know, people from the corporate sector. In your book, you focus, you know, on the big names and some very powerful individuals. You know, what about all those people trying to create their own business with purpose at the micro level? You know, what role does social entrepreneurship have in your rethought capitalism?
I think it has a huge role if it's aiming to scale. And I know everyone in social entrepreneurship understands this. But I talk a little bit in my book, and probably should have done more, about the incredibly important role that entrepreneurs play in pushing large companies to change. There is nothing that changes a company's mind faster than seeing a small company making a ton of money. So who's going to change the meat business? Impossible Foods and the 1,000 other plant-based meat startups that are coming out. I mean, Elon Musk is a very complicated man, but I think it's probably fair to say that his vision and his investment in Tesla has probably accelerated the transition to electric vehicles by at least 5 years. So I think social entrepreneurs are super important. The only thought I would throw into the mix, and my guess is that you would absolutely agree with me, is that sometimes social entrepreneurship is framed as if it's the solution. And while I think that business making a difference and business changing things and discovering new ways of doing things and building new business models is super important, I am absolutely sure it cannot solve all the problems that we face. that without the larger systemic change, without changing the metrics, without changing investor behavior, without changing how we think about governments and their role, we won't in the end solve these problems. So I think social entrepreneurs can be an incredibly important catalyst, but the first step in the journey, not the whole journey itself.
I mean, that's one of the reasons why we set up our own center, was to try and, move the debate from purely social entrepreneurship as holding all value to thinking about the corporate and the public role in this.
So, sure. Yeah. No, I know you know this.
Yeah.
A little funny saying it, but but I think it's super important, because in the early days, there was some flavor that social entrepreneurship and we're done. And that's clearly not the case.
So do you think that business schools like yours and the one we work for are part of the problem or part of the solution?
Both, of course. The idea that the sole goal of business is to maximize shareholder value is so deep. I mean, maybe it's different at Cambridge, but at Harvard, it's just so taken for granted. It's in the water. And we can't find anyone who's actually teaching it. But the students just arrive thinking that's the default. And when they do strategy or finance or marketing, that's the easy place to go, right? Maximize profit function. And really raising the idea that, no, there's something much bigger going on here has been tricky. Some people think you want to completely undermine the free market, that you think government regulation is the answer to everything. Others just think you're a communist, not so helpful. And I think the more profound response is with the question you asked me, which is, well, how could you tell? What does it mean to have a person-driven firm? We don't know. How would you measure that? How do we think about that? I think some of the most exciting work is being done in accounting departments. I say that I didn't realize that accountants were the foundation of modern civilization and the great hope for the future. But if we can't measure it, we can't get there. And I think that's an enormously exciting and encouraging thing that's coming not only out of business schools, of course, it's coming out of the accounting firms and many other amazing people who've been pioneering new metrics. But I think that's an example of how business schools can really help. I think all the work that's been done on high road employment systems and why we might think that they're a good way to run the organization. I mean, the hundreds of studies that have been done in an enormous wide range of disciplines, really laying the foundation so we can be sure that that's true, is an example. Harvard's not a leader in this space. I mean, we're kind of a little bit late to this party. Schools like the Judge School, I mean, you guys are famous for being, right at the leading edge of this. And I'm thinking of Michigan and Yale and other schools that really pioneered. But, even we are starting to get like, okay, and we need to do this differently. And I think my dean's decision to put me in as course head for one of the required courses, the required course on leadership and ethics, is an example of this kind of attempt to transform business schools. So I'm hopeful. I think we can make a difference. We have a big social entrepreneurship program too, but still a mixed bag. So I would give, what's a mixed grade to business schools so far?
Paul?
In terms of the grade, I'd probably give a B, or maybe a B. I don't know.
I think that's right.
So I think the final question, I think, from us is about COVID. And your book obviously was, prepared before the impact of the pandemic. Has that changed the way you think, or has it, how has that informed how you're going to move forward with this?
Before the pandemic hit, I was really careful about how I raised the systemic conversation in front of groups of business people. I talked about climate change. I talked a tiny bit about inequality. And I said, oh, yeah, and by the way, I think we need to like rebuild government. But it was all about the business case and all about shared value and all about purpose. What COVID has done, for me at least, is change the conversations. I'm now talking to groups of business people who, when I say, and fundamentally we need to rebuild democracy, don't look at me as though I have two heads. They're like, and how would we do that? And what is the business case? And has it ever happened before? which is a very different kind of question. Now, has COVID made it more or less likely that business could play a catalytic role? I think it's easy to see the way in which it might have made it less likely. We're going to come out of this emergency significantly poorer. Many people have suffered fundamental loss, losing relatives, friends, or businesses that they spent years to build. So there's a lot of loss, and we're going to come out with a lot of debt. So not easy. But on the other hand, the idea that things can go badly wrong, the idea that government may have a role to play, the idea that inequality is not some abstract idea, but the face of essential workers who cannot pay the rent, even as we're asking them to take care of our parents and bring us our groceries and make sure the lights are still on. The sense that the world is not working, I think that might help. And that we might really fundamentally rethink how we structure our economic system. So I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful, but I'm not optimistic. I don't think this is easy, but I do think it's possible, and I think it may happen.
Thank you. Paul, any final question?
Well, I think that's a great point in which to stop, actually, because it's been really fascinating listening to your ideas. We both read the book, really enjoyed it. Some of the ideas are provocative. Some of the stories are also really interesting and insightful. And we would certainly encourage people to read the book. And we'd just like to thank you once again for coming on and for articulating and extending some of the ideas that you talk about. So thank you very much indeed, Rebecca.
Well, thank you very much. I really meant what I said, that in writing this book, I relied on the research and work of hundreds, if not thousands of people, and the faculty at the Judge School are certainly in that list. What you're doing is really amazing. And I just want to go on the record and say that's, I'm in awe. Thank you.
Thank you.